This is the Stella Culinary School Podcast, Episode 19, The 12 Steps of Bread. Hello and welcome to this episode of the Stella Culinary School Podcast. My name is Jacob. In this episode, we will be discussing the 12 steps of bread, everything from mixing, kneading, fermentation, forming, proofing, all the basics that you need to understand to combine those four ingredients and make a great loaf of bread every single time. Also, your questions and comments are answered. And this is the Stella Culinary School Podcast, found online at stellaculinary.com. My name is Jacob. Thank you once again for joining me. In last episode of the Stella Culinary School Podcast, we kicked off our bread baking series by talking about the four pillars of bread, talking about the four main ingredients that make up any loaf of bread. And those are flour, water, yeast, and salt. In this episode, we're going to look at taking those four ingredients, applying technique and method to them to turn those four ingredients into a great loaf of bread. You see, because here's the problem. I hate to break it to you, but bread is a tattletale. It's kind of a pain. Because every single flaw, every single misstep that you take in the baking process, whether it's overproofing, not fermenting enough, not mixing properly, not developing your gluten, overdeveloping your gluten, overmixing, undermixing, and that's just to name a few. These will be shown by the loaf to the world once you pull it out of the oven. All of these flaws will be there for everyone to see and taste. However, if you understand each step in the 12 steps of bread baking and the fundamentals behind those steps, then you'll be able to make a great loaf of bread and with practice, do it very, very consistently. Also, too, understanding these steps on a deeper level are going also to allow you to pick apart recipes and understand those bread recipes better and to apply your baker's tuition to these recipes. And the baker's tuition is something that you will formulate and grow as you play around and bake and experiment with more bread. See, the purpose of a baker is to extract the fullest flavor from the wheat possible. And this really is the cornerstone of all great cooking, respecting your primary ingredient. In bread baking, it just so happens that your primary ingredient is flour. Now, in past episodes of the Stella Culinary School Podcast and the Free Culinary School Podcast, back before I was producing a lot of videos, we would have a technique segment. And we still might have technique segments in the future when they're necessary. But bread baking, as far as the technique for bread, a lot of it, like forming your dough and mixing your dough and kneading it, is very visual. And so it would take a long time for me in a technique segment to go through and explain to you these very visual concepts when you could easily watch a video on it. And we did just launch our Stella Bread video technique series, and we have two videos in it. One is actually a lecture-style video, a little screencast that drives home the concept of the baker's percentage, which we talked about in last episode. But if you want a refresher on the baker's percentage, that's episode one of our video series. And episode two is a basic baguette. And so after listening to this podcast, I highly recommend you go and watch the basic baguette video, because we go through and we make a baguette from start to finish, applying different techniques and tricks to get a very decent finished product. And you'll see how we apply each of the 12 steps of bread baking to make a great loaf of bread. Thank you. this entire episode is going to be dedicated to the bread baking process, to the 12 steps of bread. And real quick, just so you know what we're going to be going over in this episode, I'm going to run through the 12 steps for you. First step, scaling. Second step, mixing or kneading. Third step, primary fermentation. Fourth, punching down or degassing. Five, dividing. Six, rounding. Seven, benching. Eight, makeup and panning. Nine, proofing. 10, baking. 11, cooling. And 12, storing. And each of these 12 steps has some finer details that you need to understand to make a great loaf of bread. So number one, scaling ingredients is pretty straightforward. You've heard me talk about it a lot before where I say, you know, you need a scale, you need to weigh your ingredients. So, you know, if you want to be accurate, and I'm not going to beat a dead horse, well, maybe I will in this case, because you need a scale. If you want to bake bread, you need a scale. It's as simple as that. Because volumetric measurements are not accurate. They are not consistent. So you always need to weigh. And I prefer grams, okay, and most digital scales. And I mean, you can pick up a digital scale for $25 that weighs in grams and in ounces. And most people in the United States, it's kind of funny to me. You know, when I teach a cooking class at Stella, or you know, even when I post recipes online, people are freaked out by grams. And it's really not necessary to be so scared of them. It's really just a unit of measurement. And what makes it convenient is the fact that it is a base 10 unit of measurement versus the base 16 of ounces, because there's 16 ounces in a pound. So I just find it's a lot easier to weigh everything in grams, because it makes the calculations a lot easier, because it's a lot easier just to calculate off of a base 10 measuring system. And also there's 28 grams with a little change to an ounce. So it makes it a lot more accurate, because if you're weighing things to, you know, within, you know, a few grams, you know, say like a, you know, 1 to 5 gram spread, then you're going to have a very accurate and consistent product every single time. So you want to get all of your ingredients together and scaled or weighed out before you start the bread baking process. This is also known as mise en place in a lot of professional kitchens, basically just getting everything in place. And that way you won't have to be looking around, or maybe you get halfway through and you forget that you know didn't buy the one key ingredient, so you're rushing down to the store. So you know, you want to get your trusty scale, get some clean containers, and weigh out everything individually. Now once you have everything weighed out, it's time to go to the mixing and the kneading process. And the mixing process is there for some obvious reasons. I mean, you're going to combine all the ingredients into a smooth, uniform dough. It's going to distribute the yeast evenly throughout the dough, and it's also going to develop gluten, especially once you start that kneading process. But there's a couple of ways to mix your ingredients, two that are the most common, and that is the straight dough method, or the direct method, or the indirect or sponge method. So the straight dough method is basically taking all of your ingredients and combining them all at once into your bowl and just mixing them together. Now this method is usually used for bread that achieves its flavor through additional ingredients instead of fermentation. Now a good example of this are white sandwich breads, some dinner rolls, raisins, spice breads, things like that. Because when you add butter, eggs, milk, cream, vanilla, spices, herbs, when you add those to bread, then they're going to bring some flavor along with it. But if you're making what we call a lean dough, or a lean dough style bread, or a hearth bread, artisan style bread, which means that it has no fat, it's devoid of fat, then all of your flavor in that dough or in that finished loaf is going to come from the fermentation process. So instead of doing the direct method or a straight dough method and mixing all the ingredients together when making a lean dough bread, like a baguette, ciabatta, French roll. Instead, it's preferable if you have the time to use the indirect method, or also called the sponge method. And the main goal to this is slowing down and prolonging the fermentation process. This makes the bread more digestible and will coax out more flavors from the grain, giving you a more complex aroma and taste. Now, this is achieved basically, in short, by fermenting a portion of your dough, or your flour and water mixed together with a little bit of yeast. And this pre-ferment that is allowed to ferment is later mixed with the recipe to form a dough. And the pre-ferments and the starters are a fascinating subject, and we're going to actually talk more in detail about both of these topics, that both the pre-ferments, sourdough starters, some wild yeast starters. We're going to have a whole episode, maybe even two, dedicated to that. But right now, just kind of the golden rule that you want to remember about bread baking, especially when it comes to lean doughs, that your flavor is going to come from your fermentation process. And the longer you can ferment for, the more you can slow down that fermentation process, the more complex nuances you're going to get in the flavor and the aroma of that bread. Now, also part of the mixing process is kneading. And there's a couple of different methods that you can apply for kneading. If you're using your hands, you can just go the old-fashioned way where you just use the heel of your hand to push the dough out and flatten it out, pushing it away from you, folding it back towards you, giving it a quarter turn, and continuing this for anywhere from 6 to 10 minutes, depending upon the kind of dough you're mixing, and basically you're just trying to find or form that gluten network. Now, some people like to abuse their dough, like to grab it and slap it around, smack it on the table until it elongates, then fold it back up in a ball and keep on smacking it. And all this working is there to develop that gluten structure until it passes what we call the window pane test, where you can tear off a little piece of dough, stretch a thin membrane, and that membrane will allow light to shine through. And once you can stretch a membrane that thin from your piece of dough that you've worked, then you know that you have a strong enough gluten network to allow the dough to rise and expand and trap the gases from the fermentation process. However, one thing that you need to take into consideration is that no matter what your method of kneading is, it takes a certain amount of time or a set amount of time just for the flour and the gluten in that flour to fully hydrate. Now, for lower gluten bread, for flour that contains a lower gluten content, you're going to, so for like AP flour, about 11.5% of gluten content, it's going to take about 6 to 8 minutes for that flour and that gluten to fully hydrate, whether or not you're mixing it. Okay, so you can just mix it with water and walk away, or you can mix it with water and your yeast and your salt and knead it, but no matter what, that gluten is still not going to be able to form, that network will not be able to form until the gluten is completely hydrated, and it takes 6 to 8 minutes for that gluten to hydrate. So what I prefer to do is an autolyse step. And what an autolyse is it's a rest period between the mixing of the ingredients and the kneading of the ingredients. And so in a basic lean dough, where you're using the four primary ingredients of bread, the flour, water, yeast, and salt, you'd mix all the ingredients together except for the salt, because like we talked about in last episode, salt will tighten gluten strands, but also salt is antimicrobial or antibacterial, so it will kill the yeast if it comes into close contact with it. Now, this can be that's not that big of an issue if you just mix the yeast with the flour first, you mix the yeast with the water first, and to kind of disperse it. But it allows this time for the yeast to sort of get a jump start on its growth without any salt trying to attack it or kill it. More importantly, when you allow your dough to rest or autolyse for 20 to 30 minutes, you're allowing that dough to fully hydrate, making it much more easier to knead and work. So in the baguette video, what I showed you, because it was a hand-kneading process, is all we did was mix the dough together, the flour, water, and yeast. We mixed it together until it formed this loose, shaggy mess. And then we kind of rolled it into a rough ball, covered with plastic wrap, and let it hang out for 30 minutes. And we come back 30 minutes later, the dough is much easier to work, much easier to knead. Now, at this point, especially when making high hydration loaves, instead of hand kneading your bread, you could do what's called the stretch and fold method. And the stretch and fold is basically just grabbing the dough, stretching out one side, folding it back on itself in thirds. So you'd stretch out one side, you'd fold it back into the middle, and then you go to the opposite side, you stretch that out as far as it can go until it starts fighting you, and you fold that back into the middle. Then you turn the dough, and then you stretch out the other side that hasn't been stretched yet, and then the other side that hasn't been stretched yet, and you fold it back in thirds. And then you round the dough off, and this stretch and fold is usually repeated at 20-minute intervals. So after you do the stretch and fold, and the gluten strands will tighten on you noticeably, you can feel them tighten, and the dough will become less workable, then you just simply round that dough off, you let it rest, covered with plastic so it doesn't dry out, for about 20 minutes, and you come back and do the same thing. And depending upon the recipe and the kind of bread that you're making, you would repeat the stretch and fold at 20-minute intervals for about 4 to 6 times. And that's actually what's going to form your gluten structure and your gluten network. And this is advantageous if you want that nice, open, airy, irregular crumb that a lot of people like to see in their artisan hearth breads. Now, if you're going for more of a sandwich bread style, then you want to knead that dough because the kneading and mixing of the dough is going to give you a more even, dense crumb, which is what's normally preferable in sandwich loaves. Now, if you're using a stand-top mixer to mix your bread, then you want to use the dough hook attachment. And some people like to use the paddle attachment just to combine their ingredients, and then they switch the dough hook attachment. Now, if you're using a KitchenAid, there's a couple of things you want to remember. Number one, you always want to mix on number two, not number one, because KitchenAids, their motors are air-cooled, and so number one does not generate enough air to cool the motor because the motor works harder when it's kneading bread. Also, too, you definitely want to do an auto-lease stage unless you're working with a very moist or a very rich dough that has a lot of fat in it, because the auto-lease is going to allow the machine to mix the dough because the dough will just in nature be more workable. And also, too, KitchenAid, to protect the motor, KitchenAid recommends that you only knead dough with the dough hook attachment for about 4 minutes. So what you can do is knead it on number two with a dough hook attachment for 4 minutes, and then do the window pane test. If it doesn't pass the window pane test, just cover the bowl with some plastic wrap so it doesn't dry out. Walk away for 10 minutes, come back, knead with the dough hook attachment for another 2 to 4 minutes, and you should be ready to rock. So that's just something you want to take into consideration if you're using a stand-top mixer, especially a KitchenAid. Now, once you have your ingredients mixed and you have your yeast in there and activated, you then want to go into the primary fermentation. In fact, as soon as you mix the yeast, water, and flour together, primary fermentation starts. And primary fermentation is where a lot of your flavor is built. This is the stage in which a lump of clay is turned literally into a living thing. The yeast will eat the sugars provided by the flour and release alcohol and carbon dioxide as byproducts. The alcohol will evaporate off when the loaf of bread is baked, and the carbon dioxide released by the yeast is what leavens your bread. In general terms, you only want to use as much yeast as is needed to get the job done. Too much yeast will cause your bread dough to ferment way too fast, depleting the dough and its sugars and sometimes leaving that alcohol aftertaste. Most bread recipes actually formulate enough yeast, or they calculate in enough yeast, to have a primary fermentation stage of about 1 to 2 hours and a secondary proofing stage of around 1 hour. Now, this is absolutely the fastest that you ever want your bread to rise and proof. Anything quicker than that and you're baking an inferior product. You may as well just go to the store and just buy the baked bread and save the homemade stuff for, you know, a day when you have more time. The fermentation is really the most important thing for a skilled bread baker to understand and control. When flour is mixed with water, not only does it allow for gluten development, but it also allows for enzymes, most notably amylase, to break down complex carbohydrates into individual sugars. These sugars are then used for food for the yeast and are also what allows your bread loaf to brown and caramelize when baked. In fact, the point at which a loaf of bread is baked is time to stop the enzymatic reaction at the precise time when there are enough good sugars available for flavor and caramelization, while at the same time considering where the yeast is at its stage in growth and whether or not the bread is properly leavened. So you're always looking to do this balancing act between creating that flavor during fermentation and also making sure that your bread is leavened properly. This is why a long and slow fermentation, in my opinion, and in a lot of bakers' opinions, will yield a better tasting loaf up to a certain point, obviously. You know, you can take this concept too far. But just think for a second, if you put raw flour into your mouth, it tastes like nothing. It's only through that enzymatic reaction of breaking down complex carbohydrates into simple sugars, the proper leavening of the loaf, and the caramelization of the crust that the flour will be transformed from sawdust, from basically wheat sawdust, into something truly complex and delicious. Now, once you go through the primary fermentation phase, and you'll know that the primary fermentation phase is complete, usually by the timing of your recipe, but also the visual cue your recipe gives you. And you'll see this a lot in baking. So they'll say, you know, bulk ferment for 2 hours or until the dough has doubled in size. And usually you don't want to bulk ferment past the point where the dough has doubled in size or in volume. Some recipes will recommend 1.5 times its original size, normally because you're going to do a degassing stage and then you're going to allow the bulk fermentation to continue for a little bit longer. But once your primary fermentation stage is done, it's time then to move on to step number 4, which is the degassing, which sometimes people also call punching down. I don't like to use the word punching down because I think it conveys the wrong concept. So that's why I always like to call it degassing, because, you know, what that dough ever do to you? And also, if you're too rough with your dough, especially if you're trying to, you know, have these nice air bubbles and a beautiful irregular crumb, then literally punching down your dough isn't really the proper technique that you want to use. Now, this step number 4, punching or degassing your dough, it's important for a few different reasons. First, it allows some of the carbon dioxide to be expelled from the dough. If the carbon dioxide is allowed to accumulate over a long period of time, it will eventually choke out the yeast, although admittedly this is fairly rare. Now, it also allows the gluten to relax a little bit, which will help you in the forming stages, which come after the degassing. The interior of the dough is also usually warmer than the exterior, so punching down allows for the temperature to equalize. And most importantly, it redistributes sugars and other nutrients, triggering a new feeding cycle, which is important in getting a good rise during the secondary fermentation. Now, it's important to handle your bread with care and retain as much carbon dioxide bubbles as possible, because these bubbles will later turn into large irregular air pockets upon which the crumb or interior of your hearth breads, as well as most lean dough breads like baguettes, are judged. Now, in some cases, the dough will be punched down and degassed and allowed to ferment again. This is still considered the primary fermentation or bulk fermentation process. Secondary fermentation doesn't usually occur, or just when you're drawing that line between primary and secondary fermentation, the primary fermentation ends and the secondary starts at the dividing and the rounding stage, which comes next. Now, how severely the bread dough is punched down or degassed depends entirely on the kind of bread that you are making. So in the case of focaccia or ciabatta, both of which are extremely high hydration loaves, just the weight of the dough being turned out onto a work surface is more than enough to degas the dough properly, at which point the dividing can occur. Now, when making bread with a dense crumb, like dinner rolls or sandwich bread, the dough will be degassed completely and kind of squished down before moving on to step number 5, which is the dividing phase. Now, when dividing your dough, it's just how it sounds. You're taking that one large cohesive piece of dough and you're dividing it into your loaf sizes. And this is normally done with a scale. That's how I recommend to do it, because you have a scale anyways, right? If you're baking bread, you got a scale. So you weigh the dough to ensure that all your loaves will be the same consistent size. And a couple of things that you want to take into consideration or just remember as little tips when dividing your dough. I like to use a straight edge bench scraper, and those are also nifty too for scraping your work surface to help clean up any excess flour after the baking process is done. But I like to use a bench scraper. I like to use my scale. Also too, when you're dividing the dough, take into consideration the shape of the final loaf. So if you're going to be making an elongated loaf, like a baguette or a French bread, then I would cut rectangular pieces off that large piece of dough when you're scaling them. If you're making, say, a round boule or a ball-shaped loaf, then squares work better because you can fold those corners in and it's easier to round off and form a nice even loaf. Also, whenever possible, you want one piece of dough to equal one loaf of bread. And so what happens sometimes when scaling dough is, say I'm trying to make a 330 gram baguette, and I cut off a piece of dough and I put it on my scale, and shoot, it only weighs, you know, 270 grams. So then I cut off another piece of dough and I put it on, you know, I add it to the dough, and now it weighs 300 grams. Oh man, I'm still a little off, right? So then I add one final piece of dough, and now I have my perfect weight of 330. But what's happened is I have three separate pieces of dough making up one loaf. So when you go and do the forming process and the shaping process and shape the loaf into its final form, there's always going to be weak spots no matter what, whether you're using one piece of dough or multiple pieces of dough to create one loaf of bread. But the more pieces of dough that make up one singular loaf of bread, the more weak spots and more seams you will naturally have. And this could lead to flaws in your mainly visual flaws in your finished loaf. So whenever possible, try and cut off a larger piece of dough than what you need and then cut smaller pieces off of that until you get your final loaf size. But obviously, you know, once you get to your last loaf, you're going to be using, you know, a couple pieces of dough to make up that loaf. So this is one of those things that you will get better at just by sight and feel. You know, usually, you know, bakers with a lot of practice are pretty dead on. Especially if you're portioning dough in a certain range, say, you know, a half an ounce range or a 20 gram range, a lot of bakers can portion most of their bread just by cutting off a one piece of dough and get pretty close to within that range. And if not, then it only takes one other second piece of dough to create that finished loaf. So that's just something that's going to come with practice. But if you're finding that you have problems with seams or weak spots in your finished bread and it's blowing out on you when they bake, then that could be one of the reasons why. Now, once the dough is scaled and divided into whatever amount or quantity that you want your finished loaf to be, it's time to do a simple rounding or a pre-shaping or a pre-forming. So in step number 6, to round or preform, you're basically just going to make the rough shape of your finished loaf. So for a round loaf, like a boule, you'll want to pre-shape it into a round ball, slightly tightening the surface of the bread to give the bread structure when rising. If making an elongated loaf, like a baguette or a French bread, you want to shape that into a compact torpedo shape, which is commonly referred to as a batard. That will be the start of your shaping for your final loaf. Now, the purpose of this is to tighten the gluten strands and to form a skin on the surface to start that structure that you're going to be using to form your final loaf. And then you go on to step number 7, which is the benching or the resting process. And this allows the glutens to relax before the final shaping. So you, in the rounding phase, you're doing that pre-shaping, you're tightening the gluten strands. Now you're going to allow the glutens to relax. And then you're going to go and do your final shaping, which is a final tightening of the gluten strands, which will help the loaf keep its shape during the proofing process. So after the bench resting, you're going to go and do the final makeup or panning. And the reason why they call this panning is sometimes you have to put the bread in the pan after you shape it. Sometimes you'll use a mold, like in the basic baguette video, I showed you how to use a baguette mold. So you're going to use whatever technique that's necessary to get the shape of bread that you want. And there's so many different variations on how to shape and form bread. And a lot of breads have their own specific shaping techniques that we're just going to knock those down one by one in future technique videos. And then sometimes with higher hydration loaves, you're going to need some sort of exterior structural element to hold the bread shape while it's proofing. So these can be anything from wicker baskets to just a mixing bowl that's lined with some cloth. You can also use what's called a couche, and a couche is a piece of canvas that is somewhat stiff, and you rub some flour into it, and then you make these pleats in the canvas, and in the valley of these pleats, you will lay usually baguettes or some sort of elongated loaf of bread, French bread. And this is more for high hydration loaves that you are free-form proofing, and the pleats will hold the shape of the bread while it's going through the proofing process. And I'm actually going to demonstrate how to properly use a couche in our upcoming advanced baguette video series, which should be released in the next week or two. Once you have the makeup and the panning of the bread and you have it proofing in the couche, it's going to go into the stage number 9 or step number 9, which is the actual proofing stage. And this is the final stage of the secondary fermentation. Now, you're usually at this point looking for the bread to grow to a certain volume point, most commonly about 1.5 to 2 times its original size after shaping. Now, for every 17 degrees Fahrenheit, it basically that temperature change will effectively double or half the proofing time. So if you're used to making a bread recipe and you're used to proofing that in a 70-degree room, because that's your average room temperature, and it takes, say, 2 hours for that loaf of bread to proof, if you go into a different environment and now the room temperature is 87 degrees, instead of taking 2 hours, it's going to take 1 hour. So conversely, if you're used to also, you know, proofing bread at 87 degrees, and that's your average room temperature, I mean, maybe you're, I don't know, baking bread in Florida or something, then when you go to a cooler environment and try and replicate that recipe, you're going to notice that it's going to take much longer for it to proof. So you want to have some visual cues to look for. And normally your visual cues are the bread growing to about 1.5 times in size, sometimes double, but that can get very close to overproofing, which will cause, you know, the dough to become weak and not have good oven spring. So a good way to check this visually is you can just kind of very gently press your finger into the proofing loaf of bread, and you should make an indent, and then that indent should, you know, slowly spring back at you. Now, if the indent just kind of collapses in, then your bread is pretty much overproofed. And what happens when you go to dock your bread right before the baking process or score your bread, that bread's going to collapse on you. Now, it's at the beginning of this proofing process in stage number 9 that you'll want to add or apply any washes or garnishes if applicable to the type of bread that you're making. So if you wait till the loaf is fully proofed and right before baking, you run the risk of degassing the fragile loaf, which will hinder oven spring, effectively ruining the texture of your crumb. Now, common washes are egg whites, melted butter, whole egg, egg yolk, and plain old water. Common garnishes are usually seeds, such as poppy seeds, sesame seeds, sometimes oats, or even just a little bit of dusting with flour. And you'll see, you know, people dust their artisan baguettes or boules with a little bit of flour. This helps to harden the crust, and it also adds a nice visual appeal as well. Now, once your bread is proofed, it is now ready to bake. And the baking process is deceptively simple, but there are some things that you do want to definitely take into consideration besides just the obvious, which is, you know, having your oven preheated and set to the right temperature and then baking for the appropriate amount of time. But before you even place your bread into the oven, you have to score it or dock it. And this is, you know, when you see bakers taking a razor or a knife and putting slash marks in their bread, that is what you call scoring or docking. And this allows the dough to expand, releasing large accumulations of gas that would otherwise cause these big cavernous holes to form in the bread, or even worse, it'll blow out one side. And so when you're scoring the bread, you're basically telling the dough or the bread, this is how I want you to expand, this is where I want your expansion marks to be. Instead of blowing out on one of my weak seams, I want you to expand here. Because no matter how skilled you are at forming bread, there will always be a certain amount of weakness that runs along your seam. So properly docking your dough before baking it will allow the bread loaf to expand where you want it instead of blowing out the weak point of the seam. Now, how you dock your bread will also affect its appearance. Baguettes are normally scored at an extreme angle with the blade almost horizontal to the baguette, with it about, you know, around a 20 to 30 degree angle. Now, this extreme angle results in what is called an ear, or that perfectly leafed expansion point that is a signature of a well-made baguette and is a large part upon which the aesthetics and techniques of the baker are judged in professional competitions. Now, scoring the dough will also affect its oven spring direction. So if you take a round boule and cut 5 or 6 equally spaced horizontal lines into the top of the dough before baking it, it will come out of the oven slightly elongated, looking more like a batard or an elongated loaf than a boule. When making a few different types of the same shape of bread, like having 2 or 3 sourdough boules of the same size but with different flavors, your docking marks will help you quickly tell them apart. For example, you could have you can cut it like a pound sign to denote that you have a seeded loaf. So all of your seeded loaves have a pound sign marked into them, whereas a star pattern equals an olive or herb filling. So these can also be distinguishing marks to tell different types of bread apart. Now, I prefer to use what's called a lamb, and it's spelled lame, but it's pronounced lamb. And they're cheap, And once you get used to, and they're also known as a baker's razor. So you can do a search for a baker's razor. And in fact, if you're going to buy some stuff to make some artisan breads, like a lamb or a baker's razor, some canvases, some proofing baskets, I recommend the San Francisco Baking Institute. And they have the best prices around. I've bought a few things from them for the restaurant, and it supports their scholarship program. So so not only do they have the best prices, but you get to feel good about yourself because you're helping to support, you know, young bakers going through and learning a new trade. So I'll put a link to that in the show notes. But once you get used to using a baker's razor to dock or score your bread, there's no going back. I mean, a sharp paring knife works. Some people like to use a serrated knife, which I'm not really a big fan of. But once you get used to using a baker's razor, there's no going back. And they're really, really cheap. So there's really no excuse not to have one. Unless maybe you only bake bread, you know, a few times a year. You know, then just you can use your paring knife or a bread knife to dock your bread. Now also, too, beyond just preheating your oven, there will be some preparatory steps that you'll need to take for certain kinds of bread. So sometimes you'll need to prepare a hearth by placing in a baking stone. And these baking stones are going to replicate the hearth that is found in professional ovens and in wood fire ovens. Sometimes you're going to need some sort of steam injection. And there's all sorts of ways to create steam in your home oven. In my opinion, some better than others. You know, a lot of people will place a hot or they'll heat a pan in the bottom of their oven while they're preheating their oven. And then they pour water into that pan, or they'll spray the sides of their oven, or do a combination of the two to fill their oven chamber with steam. And it's this steam in the early stages of the baking process which forms that beautiful crackly crust that's a sign of a great loaf of bread, and also allows the bread to reach its full oven spring potential, because without the steam, a lot of times the crust of the bread will start to dehydrate and dry out, stopping that oven spring expansion. So the steam will allow the dough to expand and, almost more importantly, form that beautiful crackly crust. The problem with doing this or replicating this in a home oven is the fact that home ovens aren't built to hold steam, right? A professional deck oven is built to hold steam, and then you have a vent where you can vent it out at a given period of time. Usually within the first 10 to 15 minutes of the baking process, the steam is injected into the oven, and then after which it is vented out. Because a home oven isn't meant to hold steam, the steam evaporates out of that oven fairly quickly. So there are some techniques and some tricks that we will be going over to closely replicate that. But just to kind of give you a little preview, in the baguette video, I showed you one technique where you place the baguettes, which are in the baguette molds, and you place that baguette mold into a hotel pan, which is basically a shallow roasting pan, drop in a couple of ice cubes, cover it with tin foil, and place in a 500-degree oven for the first 10 minutes of baking, at which point you take the foil off, and then some steam will bellow out, which is nice. It's a nice sign. And then you bake until you have a nice, you know, golden brown color, and you reach the proper internal temperature. So that's one way of applying steam. Another way of applying steam, if you're making a boule, is to heat a cast iron Dutch oven, or you can use an enamel Dutch oven, but I prefer for this process a cast iron Dutch oven. And you heat that in your oven while you're doing the preheating. So you drop your round dough into the preheated cast iron pan. Do your little score marks, whatever docking pattern you're going to do. Place the lid on top, place that back into your oven, and bake for the first, you know, 15 to 20 minutes with the lid on top, at which point you can remove the lid. The steam that got trapped in there will escape. The crust will brown, and you'll have a really beautiful loaf of bread that comes pretty close to replicating a wood fire oven or a deck oven. Now, one of the most important aspects of baking your bread in step number 10 in the baking stage is knowing when your bread's done and knowing when it's time to remove it from the oven. So there are some signs, obviously, that you can look for to know when your bread's done. And the recipe that you're following will give you a good starting point. And after you make enough of other people's bread recipes, you'll start to kind of see the patterns, you know, see the times. You'll get used to baking bread in your oven, and then you'll be able to create your own recipes and have a pretty good educated guess at how long that bread's going to take to bake properly in your oven. But what you're looking for a lot of the time, for me, unless I'm baking like an enriched dough, something like a brioche, I want a really nice dark golden brown color on the outside, especially on my lean dough breads like the baguette. I find that that dark brown color, almost flirting with burnt, just gives you a much more complex aroma and flavor and taste than just the normal run-of-the-mill, you know, the golden brown color. Now, for enriched doughs or doughs containing fat, you're going to need an internal temperature. So if you take a probe thermometer and you stick it into like a white bread loaf or into a loaf of brioche, your internal temperature needs to read at least 180 degrees Fahrenheit, but they're usually pulled at around 185 to 190 degrees Fahrenheit. And for my Celsius friends, the 180 degrees is about 82 degrees Celsius. Now, lean dough, like the hard, crusty hearth breads or baguettes, need an internal temperature of at least 200 degrees Fahrenheit and all the way upwards of 210 degrees Fahrenheit. I prefer to kind of strike right in the middle and pull my bread at about 205. But actually, if I was going to be honest, and again, the 200 degrees Fahrenheit, which is minimum, for my Celsius friends, is about 93 degrees Celsius. But, you know, I'm not a big fan of sticking probe thermometers in my bread. Every time you do this, you'll notice that the steam kind of bellows out. And I have no, you know, data to back this up, but it makes me uncomfortable when I stick a probe thermometer into my bread and a bunch of steam starts escaping. Like, I just don't like that. And look, there's nothing wrong with taking the internal temperature of your bread. It's just, I don't like doing it. It's not, you know, it's a kind of a personal preference of mine. But if you're just starting out in baking, these internal temperatures are good baselines for you. So if you're unsure, you can always check and you always have this sort of mark that you can compare to. But I like to just take my loaf of bread out of the oven, give a little thump on the bottom of the loaf with my thumb. And if it sounds hollow, then your bread is done. And if it gives you this quiet sort of muted thudding or flicking sound, then you need to place the bread back in the oven and bake longer. Now, once the crust of your bread has reached the color that is appropriate for the style that you're making and the internal temperature has reached the proper internal temperature for the style that you're making, it is time to move on to step number 11, which is the cooling step. Now, we've talked in previous podcasts about the concept of carryover cooking. With bread, it's no different. Depending on the size and shape of the loaf, the cooling process can take 30 minutes to about 2 hours, and sometimes even 4 hours or longer. Now, ideally, you're going to be cooling the bread down to room temperature before slicing it. During the cooling process, the bread continues to evaporate moisture, intensifying flavors, which plays a large role in its final flavor structure. Now, the interior of the bread or the crumb is basically a gel. It's a starch-based gel. So even though the starches of the crumb have reached their full moisture swelling potential, especially if the internal temperature reads above 200 degrees Fahrenheit, 90 degrees Celsius, but if you cut into that bread, immediately the crumb will start to have this underbaked or almost gooey texture if you try and eat it right out of the oven. Now, this is because, just like any other gel, the crumb of your bread needs time to set, and it can only set properly if allowed to cool down properly. Now, the optimal temperature at which to eat and enjoy fresh bread is when the core has dropped to around 80 degrees Fahrenheit, 26 degrees Celsius. Now, I know people out there, they love their warm bread, and there's nothing wrong with that. If you love warm bread, you can eat it. It's very comforting to the mouth. It has that nice, you know, hot, you know, warm flavor in your mouth, and the butter easily melts on that nice warm bread. But if you really want to truly experience the subtle nuances of a good loaf of bread, especially when you're making, you know, using pre-ferments or sourdough starters and you're using these long extended fermentation periods, and, you know, I mean, you're really going for the gusto and trying to produce a nice artisan bread at home, then you're going to want to allow it to fully cool at room temperature, preferably on cooling racks and preferably to at least below body temperature. But even, you know, right down to room temperature is really the best. And that's how we serve our bread at Stella. We bake our bread fresh in our wood fire oven using a natural starter, and we bake it fresh daily about 2 hours before dinner service, and we allow it to cool at room temperature. And we serve it at room temperature. And let me tell you a little secret, okay? The reason, and I'm just generalizing here. I'm just generalizing. You know, I'm not calling out 100% of restaurants. But the reason why most restaurants serve warm bread is to hide the fact that the bread isn't exactly super fresh, okay? After a couple of days, your bread's going to start going stale on you. One of the best ways to hide stale bread is to heat it up in the oven. So that's just a little side note. If you're going to go through the process and the trouble of making great bread at home or serving great bread in your restaurant and you're baking it fresh daily, then you want to serve it at room temperature so people can fully appreciate its flavor and its texture. Now, there's nothing wrong with reheating bread. It's just not going to be as good. And you can, so the next day you can make toast with it. You can make grilled cheese with it. You can make French toast, whatever you want to do. But just know that the optimal time to eat your bread is at about 2 to 4 hours after baking, once it's cooled down to room temperature. Now, according to the Tartine Bread Book, which is a great book that I recommend anyone who wants to get into artisan bread baking go out and purchase, bread that is slowly cooled to room temperature over a span of about 2 to 4 hours will stay fresh longer. And this is, we've also found this to be the case at Stella. We've done some experiments. I'm not sure exactly the science behind it or why this is true, but that's why when we pull our bread out of our wood fire oven, we'll actually stack it on its side in cooling baskets, and we will place all the bread on its side right next to one another so they're actually touching. And this allows the crust to set, and the retained heat or the collective heat between all the loaves of bread will cause the bread to slow down or cool down slower. And one of the things I think it does is gives you a better crust, in my opinion. Also, too, if you listen closely, especially if you're making more than a few loaves of bread, when you place them together, one of the cool sort of things that happens when the bread starts to cool, and bakers call this the bread song, and the bread will start singing to you. The crust, as it starts to set, as it starts to cool, will crackle slightly, and you'll hear it popping and crackling, and it's kind of a cool little experience. And this will only happen, by the way, if your bread is baked properly to the proper internal temperature and the crust is set properly. Now, once your bread is cooled, you can either eat it or you can move on to step number 12, which is storing it. So hard crusts of bread, like a lean dough, baguette, French loaf, things like that, you want to store in paper, either a paper bag or a paper sleeve, to preserve their crust. However, since they don't contain any fat, they will usually go stale within a day or two, unless they're made from a sourdough starter, which the low pH or the low the amount of acidity in a sourdough starter works as a preservative in bread loaves that are leavened by sourdough. So if you're making, a baguette without using a sourdough starter, then I would make enough just for that day, or you can freeze it, right? So you never want to store your bread in the refrigerator, as the cold temperatures will stale your bread. But it can also be frozen with good results, and you do this just by wrapping it tightly in plastic wrap, and you want to cater wrap it, which is wrapping in both directions. So you'll wrap horizontally, then you'll flip it around and wrap it vertically to make sure that you get a good seal so air doesn't get in. And you can freeze your bread for about 3 months with fairly good results. Now, when it comes time to bring that bread back, if you want to eat it again, you can simply pull it out of your freezer, let it sit on your counter for a few hours, and then just bake it in your oven to bring that crust back and that internal temperature back. Now, when storing enriched loaves of bread, like dinner rolls and sandwich bread and brioche, they should be tightly wrapped in plastic wrap and stored in a cool, dark place. Some sort of cupboard above your counters, away from your stoves is usually a good spot to have them. Or if you have a pantry that's kind of away from your kitchen that's a little bit cooler and darker, you can store your bread there. Now, direct sunlight will cause the bread to sweat, which will first turn the bread soggy, and then it'll turn the bread moldy, and then you gotta throw it out. You can also freeze enriched doughs, just like you do with your lean doughs. You wanna cater wrap and pop them in your freezer, and they'll last for about 3 months. What would my contribution be? Most definitely political, subliminal, partially, hardly any filler of that about the process. I'm thinking progress over literary garbage, harness. These words sicken me, the future set. I regret, even when dealing with the corporate structure. Power is given. So before we get into this episode's questions and comments, I got a couple of comments, or I should say announcements of my own. Most notably, talking about our video series, I did talk about the Stella Bread video series, which has been released. We do have 2 episodes at the time of recording this. And watch for new videos to be released shortly, especially in the bread series. But we are now up to 8 different video series, everything from sauces and soups to charcuterie to the bread, of course, our knife skill series, which has our most videos in it, about 40 at this time. And they are now all finally available in the iTunes store. And it did take some time and some doing, and this is something that people have been requesting for a while. What happened, though, is I was a little gun-shy because when I originally released the Knife Skills HD into the iTunes store, I wasn't using the proper host or server, and I got creamed pretty good with my hosting cost. The Knife Skills video series shot to number one for food on iTunes and was featured on the front page of podcasts in iTunes. Not that I'm complaining. It was actually a pretty fun ride while it lasted, but it ended up in a rather large hosting bill to the tune of over $800. So now we have the proper hosting set up. Unfortunately, the videos are not in HD. They are in standard definition. And I shoot all my videos in HD, and I upload them to YouTube in HD video because YouTube offers free hosting, obviously. But the ones that are available in iTunes right now are standard definition. And I do hope to later release the HD versions once the we find a more economical way to do it, since we are dedicated to releasing free content and free cooking content. So head on over to iTunes if that's how you like to get your media, and you can just do a Stella Culinary search, and all 8 of our video series will pop up there. Also, you can just head on over to StellaCulinary.com and click on the Video Tutorials tab at the top of the page, and you can browse all of our videos there as well. Also, I would recommend that if you have any questions, you go to the Stella Culinary Forum, where a lot of nice and intelligent people hang out. It's not your average internet forum where people are always bickering and moaning and trying to one-up each other. You know, it's a very friendly forum with knowledgeable people who all share one common goal, which is to learn more about cooking. Including myself. I learned a lot just by reading the forums and interacting with all the great people who hang out over at StellaColony.com/forum. And if you are one of those forum members, I appreciate your ongoing interaction and support. You know, our community, obviously, there would be no community without users and community members like you. Today's question and comment segment, we got a couple of quick questions regarding the information that we covered in SES episode 18, The Four Pillars of Bread. And the first one comes from Rob W. And Rob says, when it comes to the hydration, let's say you start out with 60% hydration, is this taking into account that you're going to be dusting the board with flour to start with? And throughout the process to prevent it from sticking. Sometimes I feel as though I'm reducing my hydration level, perhaps down to as low as 50%, by working additional flour into the dough through this process. Should I avoid this or account for it by increasing the hydration slightly to factor it in? So that's a really good question, and it has a few simple answers. Number one, there's no way that you're reducing your hydration rate down to 50% just because the dough would nearly be unworkable unless you have the strength of a gorilla. That's a really low hydration dough. Also, if you're worried about diluting the hydration or if you're worried about dropping your hydration rate too low by dusting your board with flour, I prefer to use nonstick spray. And, we call it pan spray in the industry, just kind of a generic, fat-based, fine mist sprayer that you can spray onto your hands and onto your work surface, and the dough won't stick. Now, the one that's most commonly available in your supermarkets is something like Pam, or just whatever nonstick spray that you generally use, you can use that. Now, this is more used on the higher hydration, though. Once you cross that 65% mark, once you start getting into, say, the 68 to 75% hydration area, or obviously higher, you're going to want to use a nonstick spray only because the dough is so tacky that you're going to just keep on adding more and more and more and more flour during the kneading and the forming process just to keep the dough from sticking to your board and to your hands. Now, if you have a regular hydration loaf, it really anything below 65% hydration, then the dough is fairly workable. It's not super tacky or sticky. So all you need is just a very fine dusting of flour on your board and then rub that flour into your board and look, get a little on your hands and just add a little bit as necessary. And the, just the general rule is you want to add as little flour as possible when kneading your bread or anytime you're dusting your work surface. And especially during the preform and the forming process, because if there's too much flour on the surface of your dough when you're preforming and then forming it, when the time comes to finalize the formation on that dough or on that loaf and you're creating that seam and you go down and you seal that seam, if there's too much flour in that seam and on the surface of the dough while you're forming the baguette or the loaf, then it will lead to a weak seam, which will cause it to blow out during the baking process. Now, the next question comes from Mike, and Mike says, great introductory episode on bread. Well, thanks, Mike. I appreciate that. My question was regarding high heat temperature for pizza dough that you discussed. My oven only hits 550 degrees Fahrenheit. My grill from the infrared temp gets up to about 700 degrees Fahrenheit. Would it be beneficial to attempt to bake the pizza on the baking stone in that high temperature, or am I splitting hairs? Any sort of advice is appreciated. Look forward to learning more through the show. Cheers, Mike. Well, thanks, Mike. Great question. I'm glad you're enjoying the show. No, you are not splitting hairs, not even close. Pizza is one of the most fascinating topics that I've researched recently. And last year, I had this big pizza kick where it was my goal to recreate a beautiful Neapolitan-style pizza out of our high-temp wood fire oven. And it really took a lot of research, a lot of R&D, a lot of practice, because I had never worked for a Neapolitan pizza chef. And it's funny because you see a lot of recipes online that supposedly these Neapolitan pizza chefs are putting out. But I'm calling hogwash on them. I think they're decoys. Because what I've learned about Neapolitan style doughs, these recipes do not replicate. They actually set you up for failure. So I think there's a little Machiavelli side to some of these recipes that people are putting out. So I had to learn a lot about dough, a lot about flour, and then do a lot of tests. So here's, in brief, what I found. I'm going to try and limit this answer only because we will talk more about pizzas in the future. And if I'm not careful, I could easily ramble on about this question for the next 2 hours. And, the show has already gone way too long as it is. So high temperature pizzas, you need to use double lot pizza flour, and the double lot refers to the fineness of the flour. It's ground very, very fine. And what I found that anything above, when your hearth temperature is anything above 650 degrees Fahrenheit, so for, when I'm making Neapolitan style pizzas in the wood fire oven, our deck, the hearth, is very easily at about 850 degrees Fahrenheit, and the dome is over 1,000. Now, what happens is if you use any other flour besides a double-aught pizza flour, like bread flour, all-purpose flour, when you put that on the hearth, it's going to char, but that char is going to taste very, very bitter and very burnt. When you do the same thing with Neapolitan-style pizza flour, you place it on the hearth, and it gets this beautiful char on it, or what we call leoparding, and it has that wonderful smoky char flavor, but it doesn't have that bitter flavor. And that's why you want to use the double-aught pizza flour. Also, too, when you're cooking at such a high temperature, you want to use a lower hydration dough. And this kind of seems counterproductive or counterintuitive, right? But you want to use a lower hydration dough that's still extensible. So you can't use any fat in your dough. Because fat, while it makes your dough more extensible, will also transfer heat very, very rapidly. And so at high temperatures, the fat will burn very, very quickly in your dough. And that's when you're cooking, you know, easily at above, you know, 750 degrees Fahrenheit. So you need a low hydration dough that's extensible, and you can only get that with double op pizza flour. And the reason why you want to be low hydration is because when you're baking a true Neapolitan style pizza, it cooks between 45 and 90 seconds. So if your hydration rate is too high, your crust is going to crisp on the bottom, but when you pull it out of the oven, there's still going to be too much moisture in the dough itself, and it's going to rehydrate that crisp crust, which is going to cause it to sog out. Now, if you want to replicate a Neapolitan-style pizza at home, I do recommend that you do it on a grill with a pizza stone. And, you know, if you stoke your grill really good, you can get it extremely hot. And there's also, there's these nifty little lids that they sell for Weber grills, and it's made by a different company. I'm not sure who it is. Actually, one of the community members turned me on to it a while back, but I lost the link. So if anyone knows what I'm talking about, go ahead and, you know, post a link in the show notes or the forum. But it's basically a lid that you place on top of your Weber grill or a charcoal grill that has a slit in it right above the grill. And this allows you to load the pizza into your grill and take it out using a pizza peel without having to constantly take the lid off and on, which is going to do nothing but lead to uneven cooking because you're constantly losing that high heat that you tried so hard to build and trap in your grill. So, Mike, I hope this helped you with your question, or at least gave you a good direction to start looking and playing around. And I guarantee you, I promise that we will be diving into the pizza topic in much more detail in the coming future. But as of now, I am out of time. And that's it for this episode of the Stella Culinary School Podcast. Thank you so much for joining me once again. If you've got questions or comments, you can head on over to stellaculinary.com/forum. That's a great place to get them answered. You can always email me directly, jacob@stellaculinary.com. Don't forget to check us out in iTunes and check out all of our new video series that you can download and view through iTunes. You can also subscribe to our video feed via YouTube at youtube.com/Stella Culinary. And until next time, this is Jacob with the Stella Culinary School Podcast, reminding you to always cook and bake with passion.